This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Julian and Xiaoning. Now, corporate earnings growth has been somewhat disappointing so far this year, but companies in which the Employees' Provident Fund, or the EPF, holds substantial stakes have nevertheless managed to sustain their dividend payments. Now, according to Bloomberg data, EPF has received dividends of 1.6 billion ringgit from 10 companies that have paid the most dividends in their portfolio in the first half of 2019.
Actually, if you look at this 1.5 billion from these 10 companies or so that are highlighted, it's a very small number. It's just like a drop in the ocean of the entire EPF, 800 billion strong funds, 800 billion ringgit. So if they were to pay that 5 to 6% per annum that we're all expecting, then this wouldn't be the only source of such dividends. I think they would have to liquidate some shares in order to be able to declare that 5, 6% dividends that we're all expecting.
Well, last Friday, EPF announced that equities contributed 6.3 billion ringgit, or about 51% of its total investment income for just the second quarter. And fixed income generated 5.12 billion, or 41%. So yeah, it's a mixture of actually equities and also fixed income. The question I want to know is, like, is it mainly local or foreign? Because there is no second layer of disclosure with regards to this. Because we do know that they are pushing towards more international investments, right?
Yeah, the international contribution has been quite meaningful over the last few years, although you're right, they don't have enough details on that. But I think from the statements from the previous CEOs of EPF, this has been substantial. I could be wrong on this, but the idea that I'm getting is that they're sort of like pushing or maxing out on the foreign contribution.
They're trying to increase it, not just in terms of equity and fixed income, but also you can see in other asset classes, in particular property. EPF has been very active in the UK property market, and they recently sold some of their assets. They're always on the lookout. There were even talks of them looking at buying assets in the rest of Europe, for example, because we are facing this world of increasingly shrinking yield. I mean, in Europe, you're talking about negative yielding bonds, right? In Japan, that's been the case for a while. So for sure, EPF has to look at other asset classes, including private equity, interestingly.
So taking a look at some of the companies that have dominated the list of 10 firms paying highest dividends to the EPF portfolio at the moment, these are primarily banks as well as telecommunication companies. And this includes Digi.com, Axiata Group, Public Bank, as well as Hong Leong Bank. And of these 10 companies, so CIMB, Public Bank, RHB Bank and Hong Leong Bank all declared a higher dividend per share in the first half of 2019 compared to a year ago. And actually, a part of this number was actually boosted by RHB Bank because they declared a bumper dividend of 12.5 cent per share in the first half of 2019 compared to 7.5 cent a year ago.
That's right. They have a majority stake in RHB as well as the other financial institution, Malaysia Building Society. At one point, there were talks of a merger between them. I think that has gone nowhere. But, Xiaoning, you're right in the sense that the world returns and world yields are falling. So I'm not sure if we can continue to expect that 5 to 6% dividends that EPF has been declaring, right? I think that everything has to be looked at in context because you're not looking at returns in isolation. You are looking at returns in connection to what you can spend in future and therefore inflation comes into play as well. And inflation rates are also very low across the world today. And EPF has that mandate to deliver 2% returns above inflation, right?
Yeah, but if we look at the historical returns, I really struggle to find a time when they paid less than 5%, even during the financial crisis, the Asian financial crisis of 1997, where really Malaysia was hit big time by the recession, which is why if you look at the stocks that they have or the kind of exposure that they have, it tends to be very leans towards dividend yielders because at the end of the day, they want to actually give their members that 5 to 6% minimum return. I can see that. And also, you can look at their cautiousness when they invest, right? They are, I would say, very long-term investors, right? They don't necessarily, they have increasingly traded in the last few years. And they've also encouragingly diversified their portfolios to have external fund managers, which I think is not a bad thing because it allows their own internal fund managers to be benchmarked against external ones.
Yeah, but just going back to the history of dividends, there has been like a smattering of years where dividend rates actually fell below 5%, right, in the early 2000s, not surprisingly there after the dot-com bust. And also sometime in 2008, when the global financial crisis happened, and even then that was 4.5%. But apart from that, the recent decade of history of dividend payments has been between 5 to 6%.
Yeah, I think the lowest in recent history was 5.7% in 2016, and not that low compared to some previous years as well. AirAsia Group CEO Tan Sri Tony Fernandez, he has launched another social media salvo at Mavcom, claiming that the regulator has failed the aviation sector by introducing bureaucratic policies. Now, he cited several reasons. So among them is a requirement for airlines to notify other airlines in a new route application, a 3 times a week limit on submission of route applications, as well as the introduction of a 6-month cooling off period for resubmission of rejected applications. And it is quite an interesting collection of reasons that he cited, because particularly, I guess, 6 months, it does sound a little bit excessive, right?
Well, we have had Tony complain about almost everyone in the aviation industry except for AirAsia and AirAsia X, which he ironically is the major shareholder. But at the same time, it is true, some of the things do seem a little bit odd, like this cooling off period for 6 months. So if you fail, why should you wait 6 months?
Why is there a rejected application? I'm sure there must be policy reasons for that. But the more worrying requirements are the others, like having to notify the other airlines on a new route application, and also a three times a week limit on submissions. It seems to me that this is really limiting the enterprising creativity of corporations, right? Why do you need to do that? Apart from the time issue of notification, it's also very limiting.
Yeah, you can see why he's arguing that these are almost anti-competitive, right? Because why would you want to notify your competitors that you're looking into a new route?
I mean, you spend so much time devising those routes. These are almost like trade secrets.
Well, I don't think they're that big trade secrets, because almost everyone knows where everybody is planning to fly to. Yeah, it's not that big a deal.
It's all about the hub and spokes model, right?
Yes.
Whereby you try to exploit the efficiencies of your network. I think there is some competitive factors that are involved there.
But the main point of the regulator is not so much to curtail business, right? You're trying to actually promote a fair playing ground for everyone. So I guess Tony's point is this fair to every player in the market? And when you look at this very simplistically, maybe it doesn't seem very fair to especially AirAsia, because I can imagine them, they have the most routes among all the airlines in Malaysia. So this works to their disadvantage if they are limited to, let's say, 3 applications a week. Or they have to then wait 6 months every time they want to reapply for something.
And presumably they have had to wait quite a while, because Tony actually did cite several instances where Mavcom has rejected route applications despite existing bilaterally unrestricted routes. And the thing is, it's not Mavcom's function to determine whether or not airlines will ultimately utilize approved traffic rights, because the Ministry of Transport has already granted approvals for airlines to use approved traffic rights so long as the air service agreements are already in place. So I wonder what was the reasoning that Mavcom gave for the rejection of these routes, and what kind of corrections were needed perhaps for the route applications in order for it to actually eventually be successful.
I'm sure we will not hear any shortage of discussion of this between Mavcom and Tony Fernandez, but I hope we don't go there is some kind of favoritism towards Malaysia Airlines. If you're putting non-trade barriers to promote the position of Malaysia Airlines, and that I don't think is a good thing. I hope we don't go there.
Yeah, but to be fair to Mavcom, they have implemented some things which are to the benefit of passengers, one of which is now that there's this automatic opt-out for some of the insurance, which is something AirAsia used to do. Remember when you used to buy a ticket, it was like immediately included that you would...
It was automatically checked.
Yeah.
So that you would just have to pay for it if you didn't actually read the fine print.
Exactly. And then before you knew it, hey, why is this $7 charge for insurance that I don't need when I already may have my own policy? And then now the other good thing that MAVCOM has implemented is the final price, right? So you don't keep ticking, and then you get a real surprise when you get to the end, and that $100, 100 ringgit ticket, it's not a 100 ringgit ticket, but comes up to 250 because you checked every box or you didn't realize it. Now, the other thing I think MAVCOM has done pretty well is to kind of ensure that the airports, especially all the airports, there's a certain standard of even things that we kind of always complain about, standard of cleanliness in the toilets, because that's how the operator now is gauged. And every time standards fall below, the operator actually is penalized in terms of points.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.